Hey, Prime members, did you know that you could be listening to this show ad-free on Amazon Music? With Amazon Music, you get access to the most ad-free top podcasts. Avoid the ads and start listening today.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Wednesday, August 2nd. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Uber has big plans to lead the transition to electric vehicle use in London. But powering that ambitious goal is proving problematic. Our European tech reporter Sam Schechner will explain where things stand for Uber and what lessons other companies and cities can learn about setting green goals. But first, back in March, we told you about a stunning discovery that could make batteries last longer. A physicist at the University of Rochester, Ranga Diaz, claimed to have found a superconductor that could work at room temperature and under normal pressure. That would mean the potential for lossless and cheaper energy production. But now, questions are being raised about his findings. Needy Subbaraman is a science reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and she joins me now. Needy, what concerns have been raised about this finding?
So, as is typical in science, a couple of labs started trying to synthesize a material in the way that the group had done. So these were labs in China. Two of them in particular tried to make a combination of lutetium, this rare earth metal, hydrogen and nitrogen, and see if it exhibited superconductivity under the conditions that Diaz and his team had done. And they found that they couldn't make it work. The sample was hard to synthesize. The Diaz team had described this brilliant color change from blue to pink to red. And some samples were showing a color change and some samples were showing a change in resistance, but neither group found evidence of superconductivity. Now, one other group tested material that was supplied by Diaz and team, and they had two samples. One of them, they were able to measure superconductivity in. They say in the other sample, they couldn't. They haven't published these findings yet, and it's part of a series of experiments they're continuing to do. But they are the only ones I can tell who have seemed to have confirmed the results that the group announced in March.
The physicist behind this paper, Ranga Diaz, has he faced any kind of criticism like this before?
Yes, it certainly seems like there are concerns mounting regarding his publishing record. In April this year, it came to light that a couple of his physicist colleagues looked at his PhD thesis and found some similarities in significant chunks of it with other published text. There's also, in the last few weeks, scrutiny of another study that was published in 2021 in the journal Physical Review Letters. It has nothing to do with superconductivity, but the concerns, again, spotted by one of these physicists, was that a figure in that paper was similar to a figure in Dr. Diaz's thesis, which raised eyebrows because it's very rare that you find such similar picture-perfect charts pertaining to two wholly different materials. Now, that journal emailed folks who put up that paper and said that a retraction is necessary because it seems like they've backed up evidence of data fabrication or falsification.
We should add, a spokesperson for Diaz denied the allegations of fabrication or manipulating data or engaging in any scientific misconduct to other outlets. A spokesperson for the University of Rochester said Diaz took responsibility for errors in his doctoral thesis and is working with his advisor at Washington State to amend it. But Needy, the findings about the superconductor were published in the journal Nature, which is a distinguished science journal. What has Nature said about the skepticism being raised?
So Nature told me that they have a policy of looking at all questions that are raised with regard to papers that they've accepted or have been submitted to them. And they did acknowledge that they are looking into concerns raised about this paper.
All right, that was our reporter, Needy Subbaraman. And Uber posted its first ever operating profit yesterday, driven by growth in its core businesses. The number of rides in the U.S. and Canada was above pre-pandemic levels, and food delivery remained strong despite the reopening of restaurants. For the second quarter, Uber's profit was $394 million. During the same period a year earlier, it reported a loss of $2.6 billion. Along with rides and food delivery, Uber's results were helped by its expansion of its on-app advertising and hundreds of job cuts it's made this year. Speaking of Uber, in just 2 years, it wants all its drivers in London to use electric vehicles. We'll tell you how it's doing with that ambitious goal when we come back.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Whether you're selling flaky soul or fine art prints, Shopify covers all your sales channels to simplify selling online and in person. Plus, they provide industry-leading tools and 24/7 support to ignite your growth. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. To sign up, visit shopify.co.uk/podcast23, all lowercase.
By 2025, Uber wants all of its approximately 45,000 drivers in London to switch to electric vehicles. That's an ambitious goal, particularly considering its goal for electrification globally isn't until 2040. But it's fallen behind in its London efforts, partly due to some surprising obstacles. Our tech reporter Sam Schechner is with us to talk through what's happened. So, Sam, you've been scratching the surface of Uber's EV goals. What have you found?
Well, I found that they were frequently missing the interim targets that they'd set along the way, and that every time they set a target, it would be a little bit behind. They're at 19% electric miles now, some more than 4 years into the goal. And, you know, with about 2 years left, they have a long way to go.
All right. So let's talk about some of the reasons they're falling behind. To begin with, what's it been like to get drivers to start using EVs? Because Uber doesn't supply the cars for its drivers.
Yeah, and that's exactly why it's a sort of interesting example, because London is a city where the rules around emissions have gotten tighter and tighter. To drive an internal combustion engine vehicle in central London, you have to pay fees now. The city is cracking the whip, and Uber started giving incentives to drivers. We'll take a smaller commission if you drive an electric vehicle. We'll strike deals with car companies to get better prices in the hope of accelerating that transition. And it's almost like a microcosm of the problems that you see with EV transitions more broadly. People are really concerned about finding charging for their vehicles, and the upfront cost for an EV remains high because there's not really a big secondary market for them yet. And if your job is driving your car all day, having to take a break out to charge in the middle of the day is a huge problem. It could cut a fifth of your earnings. That's been the major obstacle for Uber to get to this goal.
So if charging is such a key issue for Uber, how is it dealing with that? How is it trying to help drivers find better charging options?
Well, they're a tech company, so they came at it with data. They looked around London and they saw that most of their drivers live in, say, lower income areas where there weren't a lot of on-street charging options. Most of their drivers don't have their own driveways where they can charge their cars at night. So they set about trying to get more on-street charging in those areas. They set aside £5 million to try to finance some of these new chargers. But that process has been very slow. I walked around London last month and I saw the first two chargers that went into the ground 3 years after they first made the promise, and months after the time that they'd said they'd have hundreds already in the ground. It's just been very slow going. Some of the local officials said, no, we have better deals, or no, Uber wants too much control. Other boroughs of London, simply the planning and tender offer process took much longer than Uber expected.
So what is Uber saying it's going to do to address this, to potentially meet this upcoming goal it has?
Well, they say that they're switching their strategy a little bit to rely more on rapid charging hubs, even if that does mean taking an hour out of the day. If they can get to somewhat lower prices for drivers, maybe make that half an hour, that would help. And they're also hoping that tightening rules will give them a little boost as well. To license a new private hire vehicle in London, that is, you know, a car service car of the type you'd use on Uber, it now needs to be a battery electric vehicle since January. But existing vehicles on the road can be grandfathered in as long as they're less than 10 years old. So Uber's going to need to do more than that to convince all of the drivers to switch over.
Sam, how do Uber's London plans compare with the electrification goals that it's set in other cities?
Well, Uber is promising to be all electric in major cities in the US, Europe, and Canada by 2030. So they have a little bit more time, but there are local rules that will push them to do it faster. For instance, in California, they'll have to be 90% EV across the state by 2030. And actually in Europe, they are hoping to get to 50% electric vehicle miles in a group of 7 cities in aggregate by 2025 as well. There's some cities like Lisbon, which are actually ahead of their plans. And so they think that that will allow them to meet that goal.
So it's not all bad news for Uber's EV goals. I wonder, are there lessons that other companies might take away from Uber's experience in trying to push for electrification?
This is something of a cautionary tale for companies that have these very ambitious goals. It's great to be ambitious. Uber says that it helps juice the market and it sets an example for other companies. But if you fall short, you're likely to get dinged for it. And there is a lesson for officials and public policymakers who are hoping that all these corporate goals are going to help them meet their overall climate targets. It's worth digging in a little bit more deeply into how attainable some of the goals are.
All right, that was our European tech reporter, Sam Schechner. And that's it for today's Tech News Briefing. If you want more tech stories, check out our website, wsj.com. And if you like the show, please rate and review it. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.